Welcome to Brave Together podcast here on UK Health Radio, an empowering resource for the parents of children with disabilities, neurodivergence, and all unique needs.
My favorite definition of forgiveness, though, that can help somebody out there who's like, I have some problems with forgiveness. That's hard and I don't know how to do it. My favorite definition is that forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. And the reason why I like that definition is because it's not attached to you. It's not attached to somebody else. It's just giving up the hope that the past could have been different.
Hi, Bravies. It's Jessica Pate here, Brave Mom and founder of the nonprofit We Are Brave Together. And I'm joined by my co-host, Susanna Peace Lavelle, author, life coach, and advocate for disability families. On this episode, number 247, we hear a deeply personal story from one of our own. Today, Dr. Zoe Shaw shares her journey as a writer, therapist, and caregiver, and reflects on the complex layers of shame that so often accompany caregiving, especially for women. In her story, Zoe explores the difference between simple guilt and complex shame, and how shame can quietly attach itself to our identity, convincing us that we are not enough. She talks about the phantom critic that lives in so many caregivers' minds, the cultural and societal expectations that amplify shame, and how writing became her therapy, a path toward healing and self-acceptance. Zoe reminds us that guilt can be healthy and adaptive, but shame can distort how we see ourselves. And she offers a powerful reframe. Forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. After her story, Suzanne and I sit down with Zoe to go deeper into these themes, what complex shame looks like in caregiving, how to untangle it, and how we begin to validate ourselves as adults rather than waiting for external permission. We truly, truly believe this episode will resonate with so many of you. If you've ever felt inadequate, judged, or quietly burdened by the belief that you should be doing more, this conversation is for you. Now, just a quick reminder to please rate and review this podcast, share episodes with your friends, follow us on social media, and check out our episodes posted weekly on our We Are Brave Together YouTube channel. And now, I'll let Zoe take it from here.
Your baby's not normal. We need to run more tests, the doctor said matter-of-factly, with a frigid distance of never having touched our lives. I looked at him blankly as we sat in my private maternity room, me holding my baby between us. Do you understand what I'm saying? He asked. I did. He was confirming what the little knowing voice had been telling me all day. I couldn't answer because my brain was trying to wade through a raging river of thought. It's payback time. You knew this was coming, Zoe. Your baby's not normal. Do you hear me? It sounded as if he were speaking through a long tunnel. Slowly and loudly, his words echoed in my head. Your baby is not normal. What are you looking for in these tests? I managed to ask him, but I really didn't want to know. I wanted to go back 3 days to my daughter's birth when she seemed perfect. Yet I desperately needed to know so I could stop hoping and dreading. But instead, I sat quietly and I listened to the doctor telling me he needed to keep on searching. I need to take her to the neonatal intensive care unit. A nurse will let you know when she's ready and you can join her shortly. He reached for my baby and I handed her over, feeling trapped in a scene that was quickly unfolding before I could get a good grip on the moving ground. Shortly after he left with my baby, the nurse came and escorted me to the NICU, a jungle of white cords, constant beeps, low hisses, and mysterious rumbles. This place where they sent babies who were sick or dying was just steps down the hall from rooms full of celebration of new life, plump, rosy, and healthy babies. Here in the NICU, time was marked by feedings and shift changes. The NICU wasn't included on the maternity tour for expectant parents, nor was the chapel, the geneticist, or the morgue. But I was learning that this was where babies went sometimes. They had discharged me from the hospital, so now I was simply a visitor who didn't want to leave. When they kicked me out of the NICU for their shift change, I waited in the small lobby where family and friends could observe the fragile babies behind a double-paned glass window. The glass still wasn't thick enough to block out the nurse's and doctor's words. I closed the blinds that were protected between the panes so they couldn't see me, and I leaned my cheek against the frigid window, listening to their concerned murmurs. She's the worst case of low tone I've ever seen. Did you notice she doesn't even have a gag reflex? They're doing a scan on her brain tomorrow. They're not sure there's much activity. Looks like she's going to be a vegetable. I stood frozen, scolding myself for eavesdropping. I knew I should walk away and mind my own business, but they were talking about my business, my baby. They wouldn't say these things to my face, so I stayed, riveted to the window. I wish the mom would go. She was here all night last night, and I couldn't even read my book. She asked me to play classical music, and I swear I barely made it through the night. Why doesn't she leave? Who's staying with her kids at home? Did you know she's a therapist? She's probably crazy. They laughed. They couldn't understand why I didn't go home to rest or why I insisted on staying at my daughter's side, but I knew. I wasn't leaving another baby at the hospital. I envied those parents who could go home and live lives and come back and visit their sick babies. But maybe, I reasoned, their pain was different. After all, their babies weren't here because the parent had committed an offense against motherhood, like I felt I had. The NICU was full of babies who never got visited. I ached for these babies as I thought about my first, my Kaya, the one I'd left in the hospital so many years ago, when I was a bewildered high school girl. I walked away and didn't come back. Where is she? I wondered. It had been a closed adoption, except for a few details and non-identifying letters from her parents. I knew nothing about her. This time would be different. My second daughter, Sullivan, we had named her. She would feel my loyalty and know I was a good mom who would never leave her. My breasts were full. They had been down this road before, 3 times. With my first daughter, and then 10 years later with my first son. Then again, when my second son came along. They knew exactly what to do. The nurse gave me a breast pump and milk containers, and she led me to a little storage closet where I could pump the yellow gold liquid that would sustain my daughter. As I pumped, my tears flowed faster than my milk. Then I felt the familiar tingling and the letdown. My shoulders relaxed against the hard chair. Now tears and milk flowed at the same time. I reached down for my thermos of water and I looked around the closet at the medical equipment arranged on the shelves, wondering where my husband Stan was. I finished pumping and exited the closet, containers of milk in hand. At least it was something I could do. I felt exhausted. My therapist's brain took a quick inventory of my internal state and quietly told me, "Zoe, you're grieving." "No, I'm not grieving. I'm seething and I'm dying. I'd allowed myself to think I would finally have a healthy girl." A more sinister voice inside me kept saying, "You don't get to give your child away and then get a second chance. This isn't grief." But my therapist self whispered, "Yes, it is." When I returned to the NICU, I leaned into the incubator and I picked up my mini-me, careful not to pull or tangle the cords attached to different parts of her little body. Holding my 4-pound baby, I felt her warmth against my skin and the contrasting coldness of the tubes. I looked at her and wished desperately that I could put her back inside my body. There, she had been safe and perfect. There, she had received all the sustenance she needed from the perfect tube that connected her life to mine, not from a man-made tube in her nose. She never cried, and she couldn't suck. Her little body didn't work, but she looked at me with clear, dark eyes. She saw me, and I saw her. She couldn't be brain dead. Her brain was working, even if it worked differently from everyone else's. Her expression told me she was going to be all right. My heart swelled with love, and my mama instinct surged to protect this little one that the world didn't understand. I understood. My shame told me that we would be punished together.
Zoe, today it's about you. We get to do a story episode with you. Oh my gosh. How different and weird, but exciting.
We have been waiting to do this interview. So, I think we're all giddy over here. This is going to be such a treat.
Yay. I'm so happy. And you are such a good writer.
Such a good writer. I was there with you. The story from your book, I could see everything. I could feel it. Such a good writer, Zoe.
Thank you. Thank you. It is my therapy, honestly. It just heals me when I write. So I write for other people, but selfishly, I also write for myself. Yeah.
When did you discover that you like writing, Zoe?
I've always written. So I grew up in such a different kind of home. We didn't have TV, and I grew up in the mountains in Maryland. And I just fell in love with books so early. I would hoard my books, and we'd only go to the library once a week. And I'd try to ration them out so that I wouldn't finish them before we went back to the library. And I started writing really, really early. I used to copy words from the books that I read. I would try to make up my own stories. Yeah. So I've always, always been a writer. It just wasn't until my 40s that I came back to it, because then, you know, life. I used to love to read, and then I did school, and graduate school kind of sucked all my love of reading out of me. And it took a long time before I came back to that. And it was one of those like childhood dreams. And it wasn't until my 40s when I started to blog and, you know, write again. And it just really just took off from there.
Who told you for the first time that you're a good writer? And how old were you?
It was ninth grade, Mr. Ritchie. And wow. He gave me my first D ever in English. And I remember I was furious, and I went to him, and I really questioned him. I'm like, why? Why did you give me a D on this paper? And he said, because you are a great writer and you can do better than this. He said, if it had been anybody else, I would have given them an A or a B. He said, but I've seen your writing and I know it. And you didn't like give your best. And I was like, I couldn't really argue with that because he was right, but I knew it was still good. So he was really the first one that told me I was a good writer.
I love that memory. I love how specific. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are the things that stick with us. And I would also even offer just, you know, from the viewpoint of writing something about your own life.
Yes.
That may be a little bit, I mean, today we're so excited to talk about your debut, your personal debut,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Stronger in the Difficult mm-hmm. Places. Mm-hmm. Heal your relationship with yourself by untangling complex shame. You know, it's one thing to be talking about like theory and yeah. practice and
academic,
system,
yes. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But sharing a piece of you that is real and true, and also what you're talking about is very vulnerable. Do you think it took this long to be able to, you know, go through the process of being able to share those innermost secrets, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I host a writer's group, and every Tuesday I interview writers. And the first question I ask them is, have you always known you were a writer and had to discover what you had to say? Or did you have something to say and thus became a writer? And I think for a lot of writers, it's I've always known, but I didn't have anything valuable to say. And I think that that applies to me as well, because I always wanted to be a fiction writer. I wanted to write interesting stories, but I wasn't really talented or creative enough. And so I had to come to learn how to tell other people's real stories and my own real stories. But this particular book started accidentally because I intended to write a self-help book. I'm like, okay, I'm a therapist. I should be writing self-help. This is what I'm going to write. But when I sat down, I ended up writing a 100,000-word memoir. That never got sold. It's still in my drawer. And parts of that memoir made its way into this book. And so, which actually was supposed to be, because the memoir in and of itself was good, but it didn't teach in the way that I feel this book about complex shame teaches. And so it melds both my own story with some very teachable skills, actions, you know, things that other people can understand about themselves and change, as opposed to just reading a good story.
We are going to take a brief break. Stay with us.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Thank you.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise, elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Brave Together podcast.
Well, I think we should have you start by describing the difference between simple shame and complex shame.
Yeah. So, you know, I really have a heart for women who have interesting or difficult relationships with themselves or other people. And that's a lot of women. And especially women in the caregiving community. We have a difficult relationship with caregiving. Almost all of us do, right? Which then in turn creates sometimes a difficult relationship with ourselves. We have all kinds of shame, guilt, jealousy, different, you know, feelings that we have. And so I really wrote this book for a woman who may have some shame and may not really understand that this particular type of shame, complex shame, is sabotaging her life in many ways. So let's talk about the difference. So everybody has guilt and everybody has shame, but guilt is what I call a healthy adaptive emotion when it is valid, because also mamas have a lot of invalid guilt. But when guilt is valid, it is simply you understanding, like your emotions telling you, I've done something to violate my own moral code. We all have a different moral code, but guilt tells you that. And so when you feel guilt, you feel like I violated my moral code. And the reason why it's healthy is because it brings us back into alignment with like what we believe is right, right? And so we can do that by trying to repair. Sometimes repair isn't possible. And if repair isn't possible, and even if it is, then we can also then decide, I will not do that anymore. So that is how we really resolve guilt. But when it comes to shame, shame is a always unhealthy emotion and physiological state that tells us I am wrong. And when you have this deep sense of I am wrong, it's attached to your identity and there's nothing you can do about it except for hide. And so shame makes us hide in all places in our lives. Sometimes it makes us hide from ourselves. And this specific type of shame that I'm talking about is complex shame. And the difference between what I call simple shame and complex shame is that simple shame is generally alleviated when we are vulnerable, right? So Brené Brown talks about this. You have shame. We all have that sense of shame. It is a physiological, internal experience. And we feel it in our bodies. We feel it in our emotions. You can see shame on people in their body language, right? The slump, the downcast eyes. We all experience it. And when we talk about it and it's simple shame,
and someone else gives us external compassion, someone else says me too, that's why the Me Too movement was so big. When someone else says, I understand, when someone else forgives us, our shame just dissipates, right? But there's a different type of shame that I've come to understand in myself and my patients and in my research, and I call that complex shame. And when you have complex shame, and we can talk about the various ways that it develops, but when you have complex shame and you try that vulnerability thing and you talk about it and maybe you receive external compassion, it doesn't go away. In fact, it usually dives deeper. And there's a couple of reasons why. The first is because with complex shame, it is so complex that it's attached to so many other things. And so if someone gives you external compassion, your response is, oh, but you don't really know. You don't know what I did, or you don't know what happened, or you don't know all these things. And so you can't receive it. And so your shame stays. Another way that this can happen is if you are vulnerable, and this happens to a lot of marginalized communities, it happens to us caregivers too. If we're vulnerable and someone says something like, oh, I'm sure it's not really like that, or I don't think it happened that way, or I think that you're maybe over-exaggerating, right? Or I remember the very first time I told somebody about Sully's diagnosis and her response was, well, it's so good that it's not something else. I don't remember what it was, but she completely minimized my experience. Like, well, at least it's not this. And when you are gaslit, right, about the thing for which you feel shame, shame doesn't go away. It just goes deeper. So that's the difference between simple shame and complex shame.
I mean, not to use your word, but that feels really heavy. Like that feels so deep. Like you said, it dives deeper. So then it can like expand and grow and take over. And I feel like, you know, there are so many different pieces of me, again, like my upbringing and, you know, culture of origin, all of that origin story, you know, I feel like it's like part of my identity.
That's what shame is. Yeah, it is. It becomes part of our identity. And so the work is to learn to untangle it, because that's the only way that you can alleviate it, is to untangle it and ultimately figure out how to forgive yourself and accept it, right? And then get into a maintenance phase.
And just one quick question about that forgiveness, because I love how you were talking about, you know, this ability when we have sort of a simple shame and we're able to communicate it and someone is like, I see you, right? And then you feel better. Mm-hmm. But what if nobody wants to forgive you for nothing on the external part of things, like, you know, I don't know, like culture, community, church, yeah, whatever it is, parents,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Are just like, no, we still think that's a bad thing, or whatever it may be. Fill in the blank. I'm just, you know, making something up here. But
right.
So then how then? We have so much work to do on ourselves and untangling, but like,
yeah,
how then can we switch from needing that external validation? Do you know what I mean?
I do. We have to honor that we needed it for really real valid reasons, especially as children, to survive. And so we created a practice of figuring out how to get that acceptance so that we could survive in our environment, right? And we've brought it into adulthood. And so we still have a sense of needing it. And it's not that we don't ever need validation. We don't need it to the extent that we used to. And that's scary, because it feels like if I'm not seeking validation, then I'm isolating myself, then I'm going to lose love, right? And acceptance. But what we have to understand is that now, as adults, we can validate ourselves, and we can then find, and we will, when we actually own ourselves, when we accept ourselves, when we validate ourselves, we are a magnet for other people who are healthy enough, right, to accept us too. Now, reality is we might still be in relationships with people who can't accept us. I love my mother dearly. I always will. We have a great relationship. And she told me it was a sin that I wrote my book. And so all of that still exists, right? That those things that I have to still pay attention to when it comes to my shame, because she can trigger me into shame so quickly. But I've come to a place where I know it's going to happen. And so the maintenance phase that I talk about, it's not that we get rid of shame. It's that we recognize that when shame shows up,
We're going to look at it. We're going to acknowledge it. Oh, I know what that feeling is. That shame. I understand what shame wants me to do. It wants me to hide. It wants me to defend. It wants me to try to get my mother's approval, but I'm going to do the opposite thing. Right. And I'm going to speak up and I'm going to stand strong and I'm going to know that I'm still okay and lovable. Right. And I accept myself. And it's hard and it's a practice. And I do it regularly with my mother. But as a result, my relationship with my mother is so good. Because I'm not dependent on her acceptance. I can let her judge me and see me in that way and still be okay. Haven't always been that way.
What do we do about the shame that isn't necessarily coming from others' words or actions, but our own inner bully?
Well, that's really great that you said that, Jessica, because shame is an interpersonal experience. And what I mean is that it did not get created by us.
Okay.
And you said internal bully. I call it the phantom critic, right?
And the book. I like that.
And the phantom critic, and the reason why I call it the phantom critic is because it is a phantom. It comes from somewhere. That internal bully was not created when you were born. It got created over time because of the messages, right, that you receive societally from your family of origin, all the things. And so when you can begin to understand that and figure out, wait, where did this message come from? What is my phantom critic or inner bully? What does it tell me regularly, right? And where did this message come from? And then you can begin to confront it and recognize that that's shame talking. And you can make friends with it. And the reason why you can make friends with it is because the inner bully and the phantom critic actually got there to protect you. It was trying to protect you from getting into trouble, from being ostracized, from all the things, right? And so it kept you in a place of shame so that you would hide. And, you know, keep you safe. I'm doing that in air quotes for people who are listening. And so when you can understand that that's what that bully is doing, it's still trying to keep you safe in a time that you don't need to be kept safe anymore, then you can make friends with it and you can tell yourself the opposite. What is, I say the courageous truth teller. So you have this phantom critic and you need to really start to play up, make friends with the courageous truth teller who tells the truth about who you are. That is usually very different than what the phantom critic tells you. But all of those words, they're going to be there because we've packed them up from relationships. And sometimes we think when we leave relationships, oh, we've left that dysfunction. We left that toxicity. But often we just pack those words up and we take them with us and we just repeat them to ourselves. And it's a practice that you've got to start recognizing and knowing it doesn't come from you. It came from outside of you. You co-signed with it and it's time to no longer co-sign with it.
I've heard inner bully and that makes perfect sense, right? But when you talk about something that's not real, something that's a phantom, right? Then it makes it less sort of present and tangible, right? I like the idea of giving everything a name. Like I name my car, I name all my stuffed animals.
What's your car's name?
Well, it used to be Snowflake. So I just recently got a new one. So I'm still trying to figure out, you know, I just feel like the phantom critic. Zoe, I need like I need exact steps. Like I need 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you tell us how to even begin to start to untangle? Because I sit with so much shame, so many different levels and kinds of shame. I have felt my entire life, really, and I'm 52, that, you know, I'm a sinner and I've done all of these things wrong. I didn't follow the rules. I should have done things this way. Right. I am, you know, not going to be rewarded at the end of my life because of the different choices I've made. So how can we just even what's the first step?
Yes. I love that you ask that, Susanna, because as a woman who grew up in purity culture and had premarital sex and then, you know, went on to have to place my daughter for adoption because my parents needed to keep this a secret. And then I eventually had a divorce. I know all about those kinds of words that you've been taught and those messages. And actually, you know, in the book, I talk about an 8-step process of overcoming complex shame. And I talk about all the different types. I think there's 6 or 7 types of shames, which we don't need to get into, or types of shame that we need to get into. It starts with being able to understand what those initial shaming experiences were. So, you know, everything's about kind of going back, because that's, shame didn't start today. It started a long time ago. Children as young as 18 months can feel shame. And so, of course, you're not going to remember back when that is, but it's a way that we socialize ourselves in this world. It's not healthy, but it seems like it works. And that's the thing we need to understand. And especially in religious communities, shame is a huge tool, because it looks like people's behavior changes when you shame them. But what we found in research is that that doesn't happen. When you shame people, their behavior just goes underground, right? And it gets more unhealthy, which is why we have so much dishealth in lots of religious communities. So you need to understand, what are those initial shaming experiences, like the big ones, and what kind of shame do you have? And then you need to understand that when we have shame, because we hide, we tend to hurt ourselves. So you need to understand, what were the ways that I sabotage myself? How did I now? There's that saying, like, hurt people, but really hurt people hurt themselves too, right? And so how did I hurt myself as a result of my shame? And usually those things are still happening today. The types of ways that you begin sabotaging really early, you're probably still doing some of those things, right? Maybe you have some healthy coping, but you might also have some really unhealthy coping. So you need to pay attention to that and start to work on those things and recognize that those are shame-based behaviors, right? Once you understand how you tend to self-harm as a result of your shame, then it's time to kind of create this awareness when you're doing it. So just trying to pay attention to the times that you're self-harming and naming the shame. Oh, okay. I know what that is. That shame that kind of made me want to do that. And so then the biggest part is what I call deconstructing blame. And this is specific to complex shame, because you're not going to get that external validation, right? You blame yourself for something. And so let me give an example of maybe somebody who had, you know, somebody who was assaulted. Whenever we're victimized, we feel shame, even though it wasn't our fault. And somebody telling us, oh, it's not your fault, doesn't work. And the reason why is because, let's say there was an assault or something. So many things happen in microseconds, right? So many decisions that you have to make in microseconds if you're a victim of something. And although someone might have done something to you, you also made choices for which you likely blame yourself. And I will hear people say, I wish I had fought back. I should have fought back, or I shouldn't have fought back because this happened. Like, no matter what happened, you're going to find a way to blame yourself for it. And so you've got to begin to deconstruct your blame. What was mine? What do I blame myself for? What, you know, could I have done differently? Right? And this isn't about victim blaming, because a lot of therapists don't want to do this because they feel like it's victim blaming. It's just understanding how your psyche already works. And so when you can start to deconstruct and understand all the things that you blame yourself for, then it's time for forgiveness. Then it's time to identify that thing that might not even been your fault, but you blame yourself for, and you've got to work on forgiving yourself for that. Once you can do that, and that's work. My favorite definition of forgiveness, though, that can help somebody out there who's like, I have some problems with forgiveness. That's hard and I don't know how to do it. My favorite definition is that forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. And the reason why I like that definition is because it's not attached to you. It's not attached to somebody else. It's just giving up the hope that the past could have been different.
Stay with us, Bravies. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at a special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back, brave friends.
I forgive myself because I know I can't change that thing, right? I'm not who I am. I'm not the same person I was then. Even if I am the same person, I may have made the same decision. I understand why I did, but I'm giving up a hope that that past could have been any different. And then we can move to acceptance. And acceptance is that freedom space, right? Where you know, like, I'm okay exactly as I am. And I'm okay with my choices because I understand them. And so part of understanding too is this other little quote that I love, which is that all behavior makes sense in its context.
Yeah.
And so if you understand that, then everything that you did, unfortunately, everything that other people did too also makes sense. We're not saying, we're not applying morality to it. We're not saying it's okay or not okay, but it makes sense if we understand human psychology, right? And so then the last phase is what I call maintenance. And that's the space where we're regularly identifying shame when it shows up. Instead of hiding, we're kind of watching. I like to think of, I'm standing on the side of a river and shame comes down and I see it. I'm like, oh, there's shame. I'm going to watch it go right down the river, right? And I'm going to do the exact thing that it doesn't want me to do. And so those are the steps, and I talk about them in the book.
So, Dr. Zoe, how do you see shame show up in caregivers' lives? Because, and I don't mean old, I mean kind of new shame that develops in caregivers' lives, in parents' lives.
I can tell you what happened for me, and I can see it sometimes in the women that I talk to and my friends and the people that I work with. There's this shame that something was wrong with me. So I'll talk about just an initial shame that can happen when your child is born and when you begin to get this diagnosis is something's defective about me because I created something defective. And that's even hard to say sometimes because there feels like there's so much judgment even in that thought and that statement. But I'm saying it out loud because I know people feel it. And I know they think it, but they don't feel that there's any permission socially to be able to say that. And yet I know that that's an experience. It's an experience that I had. It's an experience. I had a client. It's so interesting because as a mom with a child with a pretty profound disability, right? I had clients who had a baby that was born with a sixth finger, perfectly healthy child, sixth finger. And we had multiple sessions about the embarrassment and shame about pictures with this baby before they got the finger excised. And it was a husband and a wife, and the husband didn't want the wife to put pictures up because he was worried about what people would think about them having a child with an extra digit. And the wife was devastated, feeling like the husband was judging her because apparently there was like it was in her family, like some other people in her family had that. And just so much shame about something that for me, and I say that with the knowledge that I have a child with a profound issue, seemed like nothing, right? But even with that, there was so much shame there. With caregivers, it's that shame of I'm defective, right? And then it just compounds. It's a, I'm not smart enough to really understand this diagnosis. I don't have the resources. Now I've got all these things I have to do. And now I'm not as good as a mom to my other children, you know, as I could be because I'm devoting all this time to this one. And then, you know, it's the perfection. And for me, I was, even though I knew logically, I could not undo Prader-Willi syndrome. I was on a mission for years to make Sully not have any of the symptoms. In my head, it was kind of, and it was really delusional. Honestly, it was. I was up nights. My hair was falling out. It was this whole thing with me trying to figure out all the things I could do to alleviate the symptoms of Prader-Willi syndrome. And all of that, you know, it came to a place of shame because I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I can't, you know, fix my child. I can't be the perfect parent. All of those things. So, and then there's shame about any negative feelings that you feel about your child or about the circumstance, because what kind of loving mother would have any negative thoughts about their child, right? And then, of course, we have other people shaming us too. So there's so much. There's so much in caregiving. I remember when I placed my daughter in Latham Center, which is a residential school where she is now, and I had people told me that other people said, I can't believe she did that. Like, how could a mother do something like that? And that's a very shaming statement, right? For a mom who's trying to do the best that she possibly can. So yeah, lots of shame in the caregiving community. You know, and in the book, I talked about my own shame when my daughter was born. I talked about, you know, the shame over the course of her diagnosis and my daughter's experience connected with my first daughter that I placed for adoption. A lot of that was a lot of the basis for my own complex shame.
It's like this ripple effect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually making me feel a little bit more normal.
Yes.
as we're saying all of these things out loud, but wow, the way that we talk to ourselves. I mean, yeah, we're going to get stuff from the outside all the time. Well, why didn't you start this earlier? And, you know, maybe you should have did it. Why? I don't understand why Arizona doesn't make her own breakfast yet. I'm sorry, we were really focusing on so many other things. You know what I mean? But,
And the fact that you would have to say, I'm sorry, right?
Which I don't. I'd rather say maybe some expletives.
Me too.
Wow. So I just had this visual of, you know, sort of this domino effect, or like, you know how sometimes you have like this ball of grass and dirt, whatever, rolling down a hill, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger because it keeps collecting more and more debris along with it as it's barreling down the hill. Yeah, it feels insurmountable. I'm actually realizing right now that there are ways that I also even kind of side-eye other parents.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, well, if she would have, you know, learned how to, you know, let her child express themselves, then maybe they wouldn't be fill in the blank, right? Yes. I'm noticing that all right now. And I'm not going to feel shame about that. I'm going to just keep moving forward. This is so good.
That is so real, because of course we shame other people. Of course we tend to shame our own children because that's what we were taught, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a matter of just being willing to pay attention to it and acknowledge it and speak about it. That can help you overcome it and maintain it.
So I always say that we all have the not enough wound in us that, you know, comes to us based on things that happen to us, what people say to us, people's responses to us, our interpretation of people's responses to us, or people's words. And so it's, you know, a lifelong growth opportunity to really heal that and take care of that. And I mean, do you think shame is interwoven in that?
Yeah, I think the not enoughness is a great way to describe shame.
Because it's saying, I am not enough. It's not saying I don't do enough. It's, I am not enough. And I know that for me, raising Ryan, that, you know, when I would get triggered, or I had so many years where I was just irritable. I just really was so hard on myself because I'd get irritated with him with all the questions, right, Susanna? Yes. All the questions, the behavior, the high anxiety. Or if he got triggered and he was, you know, starting to act up, and it would activate me, then I would shit all over myself because haven't you learned by now to just not get triggered? Mm-hmm. Haven't you learned by now how to respond to rank? You've done so much behavior training. Oh my gosh. Why are you acting like this? You're the adult. Like I just shamed all over myself. There's so much not enoughness that can show up in the caregiving life because parenting is hard enough, right? Mm-hmm. Parenting is hard enough anyways. And then you add the extra, whether it's medical, psychological, all of it, behavioral. And it's so easy. We've all said, I can't do this.
That is 100% true. You know, acceptance comes with not the judgment of the self, but saying, you know what? I'm not perfect because perfect doesn't exist. And so it's just changing the language a little bit. Instead of I'm not good enough, it's I will never be able to do all of those things perfectly. And that's okay. Because what's important is that my child has me and my love, right? Mm-hmm. And I have a relationship with my child. And I know that I know and care for my child more than anybody else can or will. And that's what matters. Mm-hmm. And when instead of trying to not say the whole thing of I'm not good enough, instead you just tell yourself, you're right, I will never be able to do all those things perfectly because it doesn't exist. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. It is okay. I'm sorry. Our kids need good enough parents, right?
Yeah.
Good enough parents is more than enough for a child to thrive.
You mentioned forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past, yeah. right? And right. that past could be 5 minutes ago.
Absolutely. Just,
yeah. Because we are all speaking the same language here. I'm like, why am I still so impatient? I'm like, I need you to stop talking, whatever it is.
Because it's hard and it doesn't stop being hard, right? And so it's okay that we have a natural physiological response and we have to allow that for ourselves. We have to, instead of saying, there you go, you did it again, instead saying, oh, I understand. I know these things create this in me. Let me sit with it for a minute. Let me process some of the grief. Right? Because a lot of times we'll go straight to irritability or anger, but really we're grieving. And grieving isn't a one and done. It's a let me work through this. Let me understand that, yeah, I'm grieving the fact that I don't have a child who will grow and grow out of this and leave my home. And I've got to deal with this again and again and again. And sometimes it's a trigger, and that's okay. Let me acknowledge it. Not judge it, feel it, and move through it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you can be on the healthiest day. All the logic, all the understanding that I have on my worst days, they go out the window. And that's okay. Because the next day, I'm going to apply them. And the next day, I'm going to forgive myself.
Is there anything that you haven't shared yet in this conversation that you feel called to share with us?
You know, complex shame is such a not sexy, fun word or term. And I talk about it with a smile on my face because I know that there's so much joy in being able to be in a maintenance stage with it. And so no matter what in the world you've done, no matter how terrible you feel about yourself, no matter what your past looks like or your present, it's available to you, that same joy. And so that's the thing that I just want people to understand is that everybody can overcome this phantom critic, inner bully, complex shame, whatever it is you want to call it, there's space for everybody to overcome it. And of course, you know, my passion in my work is working with women specifically at whether in a difficult relationship with themselves, which is what complex shame is, or difficult relationships with other people. But yeah, I just want to inject some hope in this whole conversation.
As a woman of color in the mental health field, what do you wish others understood about the layers of cultural and generational shame that communities of color often carry?
And this is where the gaslighting happens sometimes. And often unintentionally. And I think that's even harder. I mean, when someone's intentionally just trying to dismiss you, you know, that's one thing. You can kind of recognize that as aggression. When people unintentionally dismiss your experience, it is so very painful. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm talking to someone that is not someone in a marginalized community or person of color, I would just say that people's experiences are real, even if you don't understand them, even if they're hard to believe. And if you can just move to a place, instead of trying to understand the experience to make it make sense for you, just understanding that it's okay that you don't understand it, but it's still real, that goes so far. It goes so far. Mm-hmm. And for people themselves who are marginalized, I want to just take you back to that place of understanding that that feeling you have when someone dismisses you, when someone can't see you in your experiences, that is complex shame. And it's very common in marginalized communities. And it's okay, because the way that you feel is still valid, whether someone acknowledges it or not. And your work is to really get solid with that knowing.
Let's end by telling our listeners just one little baby step to untangling their shame, because this is universal.
It is universal.
Caregiver or not, we all battle this.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say, I don't know where the shame is. Like, I don't know if it's there or how to find it. And my answer to you is, the way that you can find shame is to pay attention to anywhere in the world that you try to hide. Whenever you have that sense of, I don't want them to know, or I need to hide, that is exactly where your shame is. So just start there. Start there. That's how you can identify it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, we are so fortunate that we get to spend lots of time with you, Zoe. But where can all our listeners find you, learn more?
Yeah, you can find my book. It's called Stronger in the Difficult Places on Amazon, or anywhere, not just Amazon. You can find it any single place that books are sold. Go find it on, you know, the internet. You can also contact me at drzoeshaw.com. I have, you know, obviously I do therapy, and I'm also starting some really amazing programs specifically for women, overcoming complex shame. So yeah, just connect with me on Insta at Dr. Zoe Shaw or on my website.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And remember, everyone, remember our bravies, that we see you and we love you.
Thanks so much for listening today on UK Health Radio. Do us a favor and leave us a review and a rating so that this podcast can get into the ears and the hearts of more and more moms. Did you know that Brave Together podcast is an extension of our nonprofit organization, We Are Brave Together? We Are Brave Together serves an international community of caregiving moms, offering support groups that are virtual and in-person, educational resources, and low-cost weekend retreats. And we have published our first anthology of caregiving stories entitled Becoming Brave Together, Heroic, Extraordinary Caregiving Stories from Mothers Hidden in Plain Sight. It will encourage and validate every parent caregiver. To join us today, go to wearebravetogether.org. Our support and sisterhood awaits you. Brave Together podcast is for entertainment and education purposes only. It's not a substitute for professional care and should not be relied on for medical or mental health advice. The use of any content on our podcast, links, show notes, or on our website is to be done at your own personal risk. Please seek out a professional to assess your own medical or mental health concerns, because we are all beautifully complex, and the content of this podcast is for a broad audience.